We on?
Yeah.
Thanks. Morning. Do you ever walk into a room and forget what you came in for? Don't worry, it's not happened this morning, but it happens to all of us sometimes, I think, doesn't it? People say it's an age thing, but it's been happening to me all my life, so maybe I'm just an old soul. Thing is, though, I think we can actually live our whole lives like that. You know, we can just get up and go and do the same job, eat the same foods, do the same hobbies, go to the same places, just because it's what we've always done. Such creatures of habit can very easily just live on autopilot. And not just as people, we can do that as a church too. We can spend all our time and resources on doing what churches do without ever stopping to question why. That's why we need vision, so that everything we do is actually done for a reason. We need to be deliberate about what we do. A while back, I heard a talk by a man called Simon Sinek that really impacted me and got me thinking. It's actually the third most watched TED talk of all time, if you're interested in those. I thought it was so good, I bought his book, and it's called Start With Why. And the concept behind the talk and the book is that most people and organisations focus all their energy on what they do. But the people and organisations who succeed and actually make a difference don't have the focus on what they do, but on why they do what they do. Because what they do is more powerful when it flows from the reasons why. And he came up with this diagram, it's up behind me, which he calls the golden circle, to explain how this all works. And I just want to briefly explain it to you, because it's integral to what I'm going to be speaking about for the next hour or so. I love that. He's joking, isn't he? I am. Let's start at the outside of the circle, where it says what. Every organisation knows what they do. For most, it's about what they sell. For us at OCF, really, our what is just everything we do. It's not just the meetings we have like this morning. It's just how we live together as a community as well, outside of meetings, how we encourage one another to live our whole lives. For a lot of organisations, what they do is pretty much the beginning and the end. But for successful organisations, it's just the end of something that starts elsewhere. I'll take Apple as an example, because they're one of the most successful companies in the world. What they do is sell computers, phones, iPads, so on. There are other companies who make all these products or similar products. Some not as well, some possibly better. But for many years, Apple have really pushed ahead of their competition. Even if you buy it like an Android tablet, a lot of people will still call it an iPad. They've got that kind of brand recognition. But the thing is, for them, it's not primarily about what they do, but about why they do it, which we'll see in a minute. And the next level in the golden circle, going inside, is how. So for some organisations, this stage looks at what makes you different from other similar organisations. And a lot of organisations don't even know what their how is. They tend to be the less successful ones. Looking at Apple again, their how is all about this idea of simple and beautiful design to make their products as user-friendly as possible. And that flows out from their how they make everything into what they make, so that people will buy their products because of the way they're designed. For us in OCF, our how is all about getting closer. Okay? That's why we have the closer vision. We want everything we do to be about reaching out to people, to becoming closer together as a community as well, and of course, being closer to God. And we're going to look at that next week. But this morning, we want to look at the inside of the golden circle, the reason why. Simon Sinek notes that very few people know why they do what they do. See, the why, you might think for a lot of companies, well, it's just about making money, isn't it? But that's never the why. Okay, that's just a result of what you do. The why is about your purpose, your cause, what you believe. Why do you get out of bed every morning? Why does your organisation exist? Why does this church exist? And why should anyone care? Consider Apple again. Their why is all about challenging the status quo, about being different, about thinking differently. Does anyone remember, like, an Apple advert where a group of people were all hanging out together, enjoying a range of Apple products. No? It's because it doesn't exist. That's not how Apple advertise, and it's very deliberate. Their adverts always show people using products individually. Okay? They do this to show you that by buying an Apple product, you're being an individual. You're being different. Which is quite a trick to pull off when you consider how many units they sell. But they pull it off. Apple's message to the world is not about what they do, but why they do it. You never hear Apple advertising saying, our computers and phones are really good. Do you want to buy one? They do it the other way. They start with why. They start in the center of the circle and move out. Everything we they say, like, everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. So why? The how. The way we challenge the status quo is making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, user-friendly. And we happen to make great computers. Do you want to buy one? What Apple practically do, all the products they make, that's not actually their reason for existence. That's just kind of the tangible proof, the fruit of what they believe. It's one quote Simon Sinek repeated throughout his talk. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. Most people don't buy Apple products because they've carefully compared the specs against those of their competitors. They buy them because they buy into Apple's reason why, even if they couldn't explain in words what it is. That's why Apple have this amazingly high level of brand loyalty. For example, when Apple launched the iPod, other companies were launching MP3 players at the same time. Creative launched the first MP3 player 22 months before the first iPod, because they created the technology first. And yet, the iPod changed the music industry, and it's all about that word, why. See, Creative advertised their MP3 players. This is a 5 gigabyte MP3 player, and hardly anyone bought one. Then Apple brought out the iPod, and they called it 1,000 songs in your pocket. Didn't tell you if it was 5 gigabyte or 10 gigabyte. They told you what actually mattered to you. It's 1,000 songs in your pocket, and people thought, that's amazing. Creative told us what their device was, and nobody cared. Apple told us why did we need that device, and people bought millions of them. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. This, by the way, is not an advert for Apple. I have never bought an Apple product in my life. I've always bought the rivals' devices. But they're just such a great example of what I'm talking about today, of how why you do what you do is more important than what you're actually doing. So, what about in OCF? What is our why here? What drives us to do everything we do? Can you turn to 1 Corinthians 13, please? Many of you may have worked out what our why is just from me saying that. You may remember Tom finishing his sermon a couple of weeks ago with this chapter. You may even remember Tom actually said, as he introduced the passage, that he told me he wasn't going to use it, but then changed his mind. See, before the meeting, we were talking about what Tom would be speaking on, and I just said how it fitted so well with my upcoming sermon. Explained how I was going to be looking at this passage. And Tom said he's interested because he'd thought about using this passage and then decided against it. And then a couple of hours later, Tom's changed his mind, decided to steal my sermon. I am joking. It's not sermon theft. Oh, it is. It's God giving different people in his church the same word. And when that happens, God wants us to sit up and take notice. Yeah. See, it wasn't even just the same chapter. It's the same emphasis, the same focus on a few verses that we often miss. See, I said a lot of you will have already worked out what I was talking about when I said 1 Corinthians 13, because it's one of the most famous chapters in the Bible, because it's so often read out at weddings. Or at least part of it is. Verses 4 to 7, we hear them a lot at weddings. But by starting at verse 4, we miss the most important part of this chapter. So as Tom did, I want to read verses 1 to 3. Though I'll actually start with the last sentence of chapter 12, as it leads in. And yet, I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. To be fair, you can see why most weddings skip those verses. Bit of a mood killer. You see, you can look at the bride and groom while someone reads about how love is patient and kind, and everyone gets that warm and fuzzy feeling. You don't get that when someone reads, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. The thing is, despite what Hollywood might have you believe, love is about much more than a fuzzy feeling. But it's not just Hollywood that'll have you believe that. It's all society. I often like to look up words in the dictionary when I'm preaching. We can so often just use words without thinking about their proper meaning. So I'll look up any important words from a sermon, just for any meanings I might have missed, a different angle on it. And so I did that this week with love. I did it really hoping to find that there's a better definition than how Western society often portrays love. And it's not there. Our dictionaries define love all around how people feel. And I think that may be one of the truest indicators of how our world got so messed up. Love is not all about how you feel. It's certainly not what love means in the Bible. If you tried telling Paul that love was all about how you feel, I think he'd put you straight in no uncertain terms. Imagine it. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have a warm, fuzzy feeling inside me while I'm doing it, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. It's not what Paul's talking about at all. See, in the Bible, it's quite simple. God is love. It's not in the same way that God is sovereign, or God is just, or God is merciful. They're character aspects of God, but God is love. Love is the totality of who God is. Sometimes I play a game with my students where I think of a number and they have to work out what the number is. They can only by asking me questions that I can answer yes or no to. So say I was thinking about the number 3. I would say yes if they asked me, is it an odd number or is it a prime number? And then knowing a lot of my students, they guess something like 8. But saying God is sovereign or saying that God is just is like saying the number 3 is odd or prime. It's all true. Those terms, they don't fully describe God and they don't fully describe the number 3. Saying God is love, however, that's just like saying the number 3 is the number 3. Describes exactly what it is. It's tautology. Love is not an aspect of God. Love is the perfect description of God. It's why Paul writes in Galatians 5:6, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Paul doesn't say it's a really good thing, or even the most important thing. He says the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. That's why love is our why, the centre of this golden circle that has to define us. It's the only thing that counts. As we saw in 1 Corinthians 13, if we do not have love, we are nothing, we gain nothing. If we do not have love, we are a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. Basically, without love, we are a really annoying noise everyone wishes would stop. And isn't that so often true of the Western Church?
Yes, true.
I'm not going to start naming names, I don't think that's right. But I expect most of us could at least think of one person who, in this public sphere, who claims to represent Jesus, who you just wish would shut up, as the words and actions don't demonstrate love. So you may think all this talk of love is stating the obvious in a church. Of course the church is about love. And it may seem that way if you've heard enough sermons about love, but from the outside, the church does not look like the living embodiment of love that it should do. The church often looks like it's all about power. It's been especially bad recently. You look at how some Christian leaders have acted during the presidential election. I saw one preacher who was supporting Donald Trump. He was on TV defending him, saying that the character of the person didn't matter when you're running for president. This was after those tapes had come out where Donald Trump's saying things I'm not going to repeat. And you say, no, they don't matter. Character doesn't matter, so it doesn't matter what you said. I think that alone is horrific enough to hear any preacher say. The character doesn't matter. What made it worse was the TV interview the same preacher had given 3 years earlier, where he was criticising a politician he didn't like. I think it might have been Obama, but I'm not certain. And there he was, the preacher, saying, the most important thing in a leader is character. And this guy doesn't have it. See, people outside the church look at this, and they think the church is a bunch of hypocrites who'll say whatever it wants to get whatever it wants. That the church's ultimate why is power. They'll do whatever it takes to achieve their aims. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, they're spot on. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. I'm sorry, but that preacher saying character didn't matter was a giant clanging cymbal. And the world hates it. And it hates the church because of it. Resounding gong and clanging cymbal, though, they're not really terms we'd use much now. But essentially, Paul's just talking about this loud, annoying noise which you wish would stop. In the Message, Eugene Peterson updates this and he uses the term the creaking of a rusty gate. But I don't think that goes far enough. It's not annoying enough. When we speak without love, it's much worse than that. I think a better modern example is when your neighbour's burglar alarm goes off and it just won't stop. Especially when it's at night and you're just trying to get to sleep. And it's been going off for a while. It's just as annoying as it gets. That's how people feel about the church. See, we can complain that the world hates the church and say they're being unfair and judging us wrongly. But let's be honest. Those who hate the church usually do so because of how the church has acted over centuries. All too often, a church has been the clanging cymbal, this never-ending alarm that just doesn't resemble love at all. We can rush to defend the church, point out all the good it does in mitigation. And there is a lot of good that's been done down there. By the church over the years, but I don't think we should do that. Just to the defence, not mean I don't think we should do the good. You see, when people say the church has been a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal, when they say it's been hypocritical or homophobic or misogynistic or whatever else they throw at us, I think we should agree, because they're right. It has been, and often still is, in part. We can get into a position of trying to defend the indefensible, which is what that preacher was doing with Donald Trump. People aren't going to care about how all the good the church does if we're constantly defending the bad as well, or even just downplaying it. Our job is not to defend or deny the church's ills. Our job is to create a church that looks like Jesus, so that when people see it, they see love. They see a true representation of who God is. See, people see the church as ugly. When done properly, with love as the why at the centre of the circle, the church should be the most beautiful thing in the world because it should look like Jesus. See, Rick Warren once said, when skill combines with love, it creates beauty. Skill without love is sterile. If you want to create something beautiful, it matters why you do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. If we look at Jesus' life and all the things he did, we're talking about something beyond skill. We're talking about the miraculous. But even while he's performing miracles, what stands out about Jesus is not what he did, but that his love shone through in everything he did. For example, just before he raised Lazarus from the dead, John tells us that Jesus wept. Because John thought it was important to show us how Jesus was affected by the pain of the people he loved. Everything Jesus did, love was his motive. And it's got to be the same for us as a church. And so how do we do that? I think we need to focus on Jesus' greatest act of love. There's a word coined by a theologian called Michael J. Gorman, and it's cruciformity. You know the word cruciform, meaning the shape of a cross. And cruciformity is this concept of Christians taking on the shape of the cross metaphorically in how we live. And this idea really comes from how much Paul wrote about the cross in his letters. I mean, Paul writes so much about the cross and so little about the resurrection that some scholars have even argued that Paul didn't believe in the resurrection. Though I find that whatever crazy idea you can think of, there's always some scholars who'll believe it. But one example of this, in 1 Corinthians, again, this time, start of chapter 2, Paul writes, "When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power." Seems a strange thing for Paul to say. I mean, in one sense, he didn't come without human wisdom. He was an expert in the Jewish scriptures. When Paul was with the Corinthian church, he was probably the smartest person in the room, certainly when it came to theology. But Paul put all of that aside. He resolved to know nothing except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He wasn't interested in making the Corinthians experts in theology. Paul could have put together an amazing series of seminars and taught them so much, but he had no interest in doing that, because that might have gotten in the way of the one thing he wanted them to learn. Or you might say the two things he wanted them to learn, because Paul just doesn't say he resolved to know nothing but Jesus. He resolved to know nothing but Jesus Christ and him crucified. See, this is cruciformity, the idea that to be disciples of Jesus and become Christ-like, it's not about becoming like Christ as Lord, but becoming like Christ as servant. We so often look through Paul's writings for how to live, and there's so much great stuff in there, but we can get hung up on these theological points about what does this verse mean, and somewhere along the way miss the central thrust of knowing Jesus Christ and him crucified. Talk about cruciformity rather than Christiformity. Because if you just said Christiformity, you'd be free to kind of pick what you like about being Christ-like. Choose what you like most about Jesus and follow that. But when we focus on the cross, we're following Jesus in the most important way. Jesus said it himself in Matthew 16:24. "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." The cross is the most important symbol of the servant heart of Jesus, because it was the ultimate act of service, the ultimate act of putting others first. Jesus said it himself in John 15:13, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friend." You want to be a disciple of Jesus? You want to learn to live as he did, to copy his life? Then take your cues from the moment when he showed his love more powerfully than any other moment, when he gave up his life because it was less important to him than what others would gain through his death. That's how we best show love, by giving up our time and our money to serve others, because what they will gain from our service is more important to us than what we're giving up. That's how the world is going to see Jesus Christ and him crucified, by us living it out in a way that makes his love so clear it is undeniable. Writer Stephen R. Covey once wrote, "People don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care." That sums up Paul's attitude to the Corinthians. He put aside his knowledge to focus on demonstrating the servant heart of Jesus. That's why Erwin McManus once said, "It's more important to change what people care about than what people believe." He's not saying that what we believe doesn't matter, but that if your starting place isn't love, then it doesn't really matter what you believe. Chasing the correct beliefs without love will see you end up like the Pharisees, talking about God like an expert without having the first clue of who he really is. And that's why the why at the centre of our golden circle has to be love, because love is the starting point for everything we do. And as I said earlier, the next level, how we do that, that's where the closer vision comes in. It's because if you want to show love, you have to draw closer. You can't just say to someone, "I love you, but would you mind staying over there?" That's not love. Unless one of you has a highly contagious disease, in which case it's just a sensible precaution. Other than stupid examples like that, it's quite simple. Love draws closer. But as I said, more on that next week. And then the outside the circle, we have what we do. And this is going to include all sorts of things, but with one common denominator. Because remember, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. If we're serious about showing God's love to people, we need to examine everything we do in the light of love and drawing closer. So we're going to be talking about everything we do in terms of love, till you're sick of it. But for today, there's just one example I want to talk about in terms of how this works. In January, we're going to launch a new ministry, Healing on the Streets. I'm going to have a day, Saturday, when Mark Marks is coming over from Northern Ireland, and he's coming for the weekend to work with us. And he founded and leads this ministry. People go out to the streets of his town in Northern Ireland and just offer to pray for people. And so he's going to come and do that training with us, and then we're going to go out on the streets and pray for people in Ormskirk. And some of you are already feeling nervous. Some of you are sure you're busy that weekend, even though I haven't told you which weekend it is. We're not going to force anyone to go out on the streets and pray for people. But please don't let that stop you from coming along. This is something really important for the future of this church and for the future of this town. And trust me, you won't want to miss it. It's important because it is love in action. See, love has to be the motive behind this. Because who in their right mind is going to offer and pray for a stranger to be healed unless they're motivated by love? What if nothing happens? See, what if I look stupid? It's easy to come up with reasons not to do it. But love takes those risks. See, also though, what about if we asked, what if God shows up in power and we see miracles on the streets of Ormskirk? Love looks at it that way. See, God wants to change lives in this town. But he wants to do it through his people. If you want to see a miracle, you've got to be willing to put yourself in the place where you need a miracle, where God's got to come through or it doesn't work out. And then again, what if nothing happens, but despite that, people see our love anyway because we're willing to go out on the streets week after week, go out on a limb for people. Remember, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. They'll see love in it. So please, mark that weekend. It's Saturday the 21st of January. Put it in your diaries and make sure you're there. You won't be made to do anything you don't want to do. But at the very least, you can come and hear what Mark Marks has to say. Do the training. And if it's really not for you, you can stay inside and pray for those who are going out on the streets. I just want to finish with a story. Has anyone ever heard of a man called Samuel Pierpont Langley? No, no one ever has. He should be remembered. He was an astronomer, physicist, and inventor. Worked at Harvard University and the Smithsonian Institution. He won international awards. He should be well remembered, but few of those who have heard of him, those who do know him, they seem to remember him for failure. In 1898, the American War Department gave him $50,000 to develop the first piloted aeroplane. And he could afford to hire America's brightest minds, get the finest materials. So for 5 years, he worked at it without success until in December 1903, he decided to quit. Now, this might seem a strange question, given that none of you knew who he was. But does anyone know why he quit? Anyone know what happened in December 1903? In that month, the first ever piloted aircraft took flight, the Kitty Hawk. Successfully completed its maiden voyage, and it was nothing to do with Samuel Pierpont Langley. It was the Wright brothers. And when he heard that happened, Langley just quit. He didn't have to. He could have carried on working at his plane, just like Apple didn't quit on the iPod because Creative brought theirs out a couple of years earlier. He could have built a better, faster plane, but he wasn't first, so he wasn't interested. I don't think the Wright brothers would have quit, though, if Langley had been first. Because they had something he didn't have. They didn't have his $50,000 grant. They just had the proceeds from their bicycle shop in Ohio. They didn't work at Harvard or the Smithsonian. They didn't even have high school diplomas. They couldn't hire America's finest minds, but their enthusiasm meant they gathered a group of friends from their hometown to help them. They didn't have a chance on paper, really, when you look at it. But that enthusiasm they had, they gathered a team together. It all happened because they started from the centre of the circle, They started from their reason why. They wanted to fly, and that was their focus. And everything they did was just focused so much on that. They wanted to be part of the long list of pioneers who take the next step, who move the world forwards. So everything flowed from that reason why until they succeeded. And Langley, he didn't start with why. I'm not saying he didn't want to succeed, but he didn't have that passion at the centre. And so his team didn't have the same enthusiasm that the Wright brothers' team they had, even though they were more qualified. And that's why you've all heard of the Wright brothers and none of you have heard of Samuel Pierpont Langley. We have to start with our why, our reason for doing what we do. We do not want to be the Samuel Pierpont Langley of churches. And I know that sounds silly, but just like Langley, he was probably there for the money and the prestige and because it was the next big job for him. We can be here just because we're Christians and we've been saved by Jesus, so coming to church is just what you do until you die and go to heaven. Whereas if you're in the Wright brothers of churches, you're there for a purpose. There's a reason why at the centre of everything. And it's a reason why that transmits to others because of the enthusiasm that's there for it. And it's love. It's not a fuzzy feeling, so don't wait for that. I very much doubt Jesus had a nice warm and fuzzy feeling when he went to the cross. But that doesn't mean it wasn't love. It was the greatest act of love this world will ever know. And it's now our job to take that love to others. Although, if you go and show love even if you don't feel like it, you often find you get that warm and fuzzy feeling when you see the results. I know I said I was finishing this with the story, but I'm really finishing with communion. So could someone please go and tell the kids' church in Crest we've finished so they can take communion with us? And if the music ministry team could come up too, please, it'd be great, thanks. See, when we take communion, it shouldn't just be about thanking God for forgiving our sins. That's obviously an important part of it, but communion's bigger than that. When Jesus gave the first communion to the disciples at the Last Supper, he described the wine as the blood of the covenant. When we take communion, it's a sign of our covenant with Jesus, that we're committed to living as his disciples, to living cruciform, to being servants who give up what they have to demonstrate his love to the world. So as we eat this bread and drink the juice, let's not just remember that Jesus died on the cross for us. Let's remember that Jesus calls us to join him, to each take up our cross and follow him by living out lives of love, whatever the cost, so that when people look at us, they'll see the love of Jesus shining through. Thanks.